Hi. I'm not used to speaking into a microphone. Sorry, just get myself sorted a little bit. Don't need that. Just take a second to look at who I'm talking to. I'm Nika. I've been studying at VOS with Peter, who you all know, for several years now. I did my Bachelor of Theology, finished that a few years ago, and now I'm nearly finished with honours. So what I'm sharing with you guys this morning is a very condensed version of a research project that I did as part of my honours program. Just by way of introduction, when I started studying at VOS, I thought that theology would be the thing that I would be really interested in. That didn't turn out to be the case so much. I did really love it. I studied philosophy and stuff previously at UWA, so that's kind of like an interest of mine generally. But when I went to VOS, I just found myself really drawn to the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament, and particularly to the narratives. And I found that I, like most of us, was raised in a certain tradition. And as I approached these narratives, I approached them thinking that I sort of had some sense of what the stories were about and what they meant for us, you know, their application. And as I read them at VOS and kind of just read them, letting them say what they wanted to say, maybe just putting my tradition to the side for a moment and just letting the stories kind of say what they wanted to say, I found that the stories are actually full of ambiguities and possibilities, and that the tradition that I had kind of been raised in and the way that I'd been taught to read the story, to read it in that way, really required me to ignore a lot of what was going on in the story and only really pay attention to certain parts and ignore the other parts. And then when I started learning to read the stories in their original Hebrew, it was just kind of like that experience on steroids, because the Hebrew language is so open and so full of possibility. And I found that even the translations that we've received close off so many possibilities that are there in the original story. This is true of all Hebrew narrative, all of those stories, but I wanted to look at the Garden of Eden story because this story, more than any other, I think it's fair to say, has been so foundational in the development of Christian theology. And I feel pretty confident that we're all probably comfortable acknowledging that the dominant Christian tradition has been responsible for a lot of really good things and also a lot of really bad things. That's pretty safe to say. Good. It's a good group that I'm talking to, then I feel safe. And particularly a lot of, or several really key ideas in the dominant Christian tradition that I think anyway are particularly harmful and have caused quite considerable harm, developed really out of the Garden of Eden story. So that's why I kind of wanted to go and look at it. Excuse me. All right. It's a difficult, yeah, and I found, sorry, that as I looked at the Garden of Eden story, that the dominant interpretation of it that I had kind of grown up with and that I'm sure we've all grown up with, actually I became convinced that that is not necessarily the best reading of that story. It's a difficult subject to broach because it is so foundational for many of us. So I just wanted to acknowledge that right off the bat, that it's fairly natural to respond with a bit of resistance when something really foundational and something that we've kind of thought we could take for granted is questioned or challenged. So that's fine. I don't want anyone to think this morning that I'm suggesting that we get rid of the old version and replace it with a new version. Not at all. What I hope to do more than anything is just to maybe shed light or draw attention to the ambiguities and the possibilities that exist within the story. So, with that, it's my little introduction to my actual introduction. that I will dive into now. So we're looking at Genesis 2 and 3 and the human maturation paradigm. I hate saying that word, maturation. It just feels like a really, the kids are gone, I can say it feels like a wanky word to say, but and I have to say it so many times, so just bear with me. Reconsidering the serpent, the woman, and the forbidden fruit. We're not going to read through the Garden of Eden story just because of like time, but I'm hoping that we're all sort of familiar. But then that's the thing, is that these stories we think that we're so familiar with, often like those are the ones that they're the most dangerous stories because we think we know them. Okay. Most interpretations of the Eden myth are variations of the sin and fall theme. It's assumed that the human beings are created immortal and placed in a perfect world devoid of oppositional forces. The human beings fall from perfection and immortality because of their sin of disobedience and are punished with pain and labor and expelled from paradise. This traditional interpretation relies on certain assumptions, particularly regarding the nature and function of the serpent, the woman, and the forbidden fruit. The garden's serpent became God's cosmic opponent, Satan. The woman became the devil's gateway, and thus all women became agents of Satan. And the interpretation of the forbidden fruit around the sin and fall theme led to the doctrine of original sin. These readings have provided the basis for an exceedingly negative view of humanity, of human nature, of human sexuality, and have cast a long shadow over Western civilization. Yet biblical scholars have long recognized the many problems and illogical aspects of this traditional interpretation and have observed that the biblical account is in many ways plainly at odds with the story as it exists in the Christian tradition. The traditional interpretation also raises numerous questions. For example, if God's original creation is a paradise necessarily devoid of oppositional forces, why is there an evil serpent in it? And how can it contain a tree of knowledge of good and bad? Why did God place the tree in the garden? Was it a test? Is God anxious or insecure about the docility of his creatures? If God wanted the humans to remain in the garden forever, why did he create the rest of the world? If the humans are created immortal, why are they created sexual? If the human is created to cultivate the ground in 2:5, why is this considered punishment in 3:23? Why is the Eden myth not mentioned elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible as an example of sin, fall, and punishment, despite plentiful opportunities? And the entire biblical witness places a high value on wisdom. So why make the object of disobedience such a worthy goal to pursue? Does God want to keep humans like children rather than like adults? Does he ask for obedience without thought, to commands without reason? Or is the tree there to provoke the humans to do just what they do? Did God want the humans to trespass the prohibition? Is that why he's so conspicuously absent in the crucial scene? John Goldengay writes, I wondered, he's writing from the perspective of Eve, imaginatively, of course, because we don't have her perspective, because maybe she wasn't a real person, I don't know. maybe she was, maybe she wasn't, I don't know. That's not what today's about. John Goldengay writes, I wondered whether God might have been saying things that we were expected not to accept. After all, teachers succeed not by giving their pupils all the answers. Teachers ask questions, wonder out loud, tell jokes, exaggerate, speak ironically. Does God tell stories, seek to provoke, say things that are only half meant, rejoice to be a little paradoxical and not obviously coherent because people learn better if they figure things out for themselves? Might God's words have been designed for them to question? Moreover, the sin and fall interpretation does not respect the story's obvious mythical elements and symbols. It ignores the story's many word plays, and its completely negative symbolism of the serpent is actually incompatible with serpent symbolism in biblical Israel. These and many other problems may indicate that there is a lack of integrity between the interpretation and the text. So a number of scholars have moved away from the sin and fall paradigm. You'd never know it being like in church. I'm saying these kind of things and my friends are always like, how can this be? Why have I never heard this? A number of scholars have moved away from the sin and fall paradigm and toward a maturation paradigm. It's argued that the structure of the Eden myth portrays the general stages of maturation from birth and infancy through adolescence and into adulthood. The story is not about sin or a fall at all, but rather about the natural and necessary process by which God moves the humans from the childhood world of the garden to the adult world beyond. This project provides a brief overview of how the serpent, the woman, and the forbidden fruit have been understood within the dominant Christian tradition according to the sin and fall paradigm, before reconsidering them through a close reading of the biblical text according to the maturation paradigm. And it finds that the maturation paradigm is a little bit better. Not perfect, again, I'm going to reiterate that. It's not perfect, but it's a little bit better. Okay, so the sin and fall paradigm that we're all pretty familiar with. I think we're all familiar with it, but we're not super familiar with it. Like, if you actually kind of looked into it a bit more closely, we'd all be horrified, as I have been doing this project. So the serpent, it has long been assumed within Christian tradition that the serpent was hostile toward the humans and acted with the intention of deceiving them. In the absence of any explanation as to why this might be the case, another assumption was introduced. The serpent was either an agent of Satan or Satan in disguise. And the woman, the devil's gateway. Traditional readings blame the woman for the fall and advocate male supremacy on the basis of female moral inferiority. The late 2nd century apologist Tertullian wrote, "You, woman, also are an Eve. You are the devil's gateway. You are the unsealer of that tree. You are the first forsaker of the divine law. You are the one who persuaded him whom the devil was not brave enough to approach. You so light, just you wait. You so lightly crushed the image of God, the man Adam. Because of your punishment, that is death, even the Son of God had to die." In the 3rd century, both Ambrose and Augustine echo and reinforce this belief that women are the cause of sin and the reason mankind was led astray. Women are the incarnation of temptation and must therefore be controlled and subdued by superior male figures. This view would be passed on as orthodoxy to be repeated in substantially the same form by Aquinas, who actually made it far worse, and again into the Reformation churches by Luther and Calvin. Can you tell that these men were, for the most part, not having sex? A lot of repression going on. Okay, and the forbidden fruit. The Augustinian doctrine of original sin affirms that as a result of the fall, all human beings are born into a state of estrangement from God. And original sin that condemns all individuals prior to and apart from their committing any actual sins. Humans lost their moral freedom as a result of the fall. All are born with a stain on their souls and in need of divine atonement. The doctrine of original sin is not found in the Hebrew Bible. In fact, there is no reference to sin in the narrative purported by tradition to be, in essence, about the beginning of sin in the world. None of the words that are part of the Hebrew vocabulary for sin and transgression are used in the Eden myth. So Carol Myers, I'm going to just be saying these names, these are Old Testament scholars. Carol Myers asks, if sin be removed from consideration as the basic thematic element of the Eden tale, what might take its place? Very suspense. Okay, so now we're going to jump into the story and see if we can read it differently. The story of Eden begins with the assertion that when earth is created, it is dry and infertile, lacking water and a cultivator. Yahweh Elohim, that's so in our English translations, we get the Lord God. that's Yahweh Elohim, causes water to rise to the surface of earth so that the ground becomes fertile and has potential for growth and production. The Eden myth has long been observed to underscore the essential correspondence between the humankind and the earth, particularly through the creation of the human from the ground. It's the Adam from the Adama, or the groundling from the ground, or the earthling from the earth. And it is suggested that this change in the natural world foreshadows the change that will occur in humankind. This section, and also the later section about the one river that branches out from Eden, contribute nothing to the sin and fall paradigm. They are generally considered extraneous and ignored. According to the maturation paradigm, both this infertile earth becoming fertile and the single river branching out from Eden are instances where the natural world undergoes a process of maturation that foreshadows the process its inhabitants will also undergo. Beautiful images for your viewing pleasure. Yahweh Elohim formed the Adam from the dust of the Adama. He blew into its nostrils the breath of life, and the Adam became a living being. Yahweh Elohim planted a garden in Eden in the east, and there he put the Adam whom he had formed. Yahweh Elohim plants the garden as a separate, cultivated place. The garden doesn't exist prior to the creation of the human, or the Adam, but is planted as an environment for it. The garden is planted in Eden, which can mean pleasant or plain or steppe, so it's just like a very pleasant place. And in the east, which a number of scholars suggest could symbolize the beginning of the day or the beginning of life or just the beginning in general. Yahweh Elohim causes trees to grow in the garden, and among them are the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of Tov and Ra. Practically all Bibles translate this good and evil, which has encouraged an understanding of this knowledge as the capacity for moral discernment, but commentators regularly observe that such a translation is too narrow and too restricted to the moral dimension. The Hebrew words mean good and bad in the broadest sense. A number of scholars have noted that the Hebrew verb to know, yada, can indicate not only intellectual knowledge but also experiential knowledge, and have suggested that the knowledge of good and bad in the Eden myth refers to experiential knowledge of good and bad, to know as in to have the experience of. And that the presence of the tree in the garden from the beginning indicates that the Adam should eventually acquire such knowledge. The limitation set by Yahweh Elohim is meant to keep the Adam from acquiring such knowledge prematurely. Like a parent telling their child not to cross the street alone, knowing full well that the child will grow up and eventually cross the street alone, but that kind of idea. Now the serpent was the most arum of all the land animals which Yahweh Elohim had made. So here this word arum has been translated subtle, cunning, shrewd, or usually crafty. The serpent was the most crafty of all the animals. Such translations predispose the reader to an unfavorable assessment of the character of the snake, of the serpent, sorry. Serpent, snake, potato, potato. But arum is used elsewhere, particularly throughout the wisdom literature, with both positive and negative connotations. It's used a number of times in Proverbs of someone who is contrasted with a fool, and in these instances is translated prudent or wise. You know, all through Proverbs, it goes on for ages, you know, the fool does this, but the wise person does this. That's arum, is this word for the wise person. In the Eden myth, the description of the serpent as arum is qualified by its identification as one of the land animals made by Yahweh Elohim. To see the serpent as a divine or semi-divine being which invades the garden is to ignore the fact that we're explicitly asked to see the serpent as a land animal which belongs in the garden. It's like a party going on next door. Oh, that's fun. Okay. My face hurts from smiling from that children's story. So fun. I love it. Okay. The serpent directly contradicts Yahweh Elohim's threat of imminent death. Yahweh Elohim had said, on the day you eat of it, or as soon as you eat of it, you will die. You will certainly die even. It's like a really strong. The serpent says, you will not die. For Elohim knows that on the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like Elohim, knowing Tov and Ra. Before the 20th century, very few commentators recognized that the serpent was telling the truth. God tells them, you eat the fruit, you will die. They eat the fruit. Spoilers. They eat the fruit. They don't die. Because it was considered unacceptable that God would mislead the humans, it was argued that the humans must have been created immortal and they lost their immortality. That God, in fact, threatened eventual death, not imminent death. But according to the text, the humans are created mortal, and death is part of the original created order. The tree of life, introduced in 2:9, reappears in 3:22 when Yahweh Elohim contemplates the possibility that the Adam might acquire immortality. So the serpent is not presented as necessarily evil or hostile or deceptive. It doesn't twist anyone's words. It doesn't mislead the humans. If anyone can be called deceptive in the story, it sort of has to be Yahweh Elohim. The serpent, in fact, tells the humans the truth, where Yahweh Elohim apparently, for some reason, has not. All right. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and desirable for gaining wisdom, she took the fruit and ate, and she gave also to her man who was with her, and he ate. The narration, offers sympathetic insight into the woman's state of mind, which is actually very uncommon in the Hebrew Bible. We don't have to guess at her motivations. This really cracks me up. We don't have to guess at her motivations because they're actually made explicit. The tree is good for food, a delight to the eyes, and desirable for gaining wisdom. We're told exactly why she does what she does. Interestingly, the serpent also said that they would be like Elohim, but this aspect is not echoed in the woman's thought process. In the Christian tradition, we have seen that Eve tempted, beguiled, lured, corrupted, persuaded, taught, counseled, suggested, urged, used wicked persuasion, led into wrongdoing, proved herself an enemy, used guile and cozening, tears and lamentations to prevail upon Adam, had no rest until she got her husband banished, and thus became the first temptress. The text, however, does not present a malignant sinner with a mind to usurp divine prerogatives. And the narrator does not characterize their eating as sin. Is the story interested in sin? Does it intend to portray rebellion? Or is it maybe something else? And their eyes were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths or something for themselves. Loincloth seems to be kind of like the idea. The narration seems to emphasize the truth of the serpent's assertion through its immediate echo of the serpent's exact words. And their eyes were opened, and they knew. That they were naked. Yahweh Elohim will later say, the Adam has become like one of us, knowing Tov and Ra. So this awareness of their nakedness apparently constitutes, or at least is the immediate expression of, their newly acquired capacity for knowledge of Tov and Ra. We know that the two of them have in fact been naked all along, because we were told that earlier. So the only change that is said to have taken place is a change in their perception. It's not that the world changes once the fruit is eaten, but that their eyes are opened. so that they see the world as it is, as they have not seen it before. They perceive their nakedness, and they attempt to cover themselves and to hide. The traditional interpretation has read their fear as fear of punishment, as a reaction to guilt for sin, because the traditional interpretation was produced within a guilt innocence society. But ancient Israel was an honor shame society. Obviously, there's like a lot to be said about this, but just in a nutshell, ancient Israel was an honor shame society. And in a society where shame is the major means of social control, this first experience of shame is critical to the socialization process and viewed positively. So for an ancient Israelite reader of the story, it's like what is happening right now is a positive experience that a person has as they go through a process of maturation. Sin, guilt, fear of punishment, these simply are not presented as relevant categories. So Yahweh Elohim asks them, "What is this you have done?" And continues, "Because you have done this." The traditional interpretation envisions this section as a distribution of punishments or curses. Others understand Yahweh Elohim to speak descriptively rather than prescriptively about the consequences of living with the adult knowledge they've acquired. The humans essentially learn about the oppositional forces of life, particularly as they pertain to their uniquely male and female roles in their ancient group-oriented society, and about the reality of death. This section represents a change in perception from the previous immature understanding of life, not a change in the actual conditions of life. It's not that childbirth was once painless and has now become painful, but that the woman was previously unaware of the reality of childbirth, because this is a reality faced by adult women. Childbirth was always going to involve pain. Hard labor was always going to be hard labor. And they were always going to die. Just as the humans were naked before they knew their nakedness, so these conditions pertained before they were aware of them. Historian Elaine Pagels writes that for millennia, the Eden story has been read as making the empirically absurd claim that death does not constitute the natural end of all lives, but intruded upon our species because Adam and Eve made the wrong choice. The traditional interpretation has understood death as punishment, but the text presents death as a return to the original unity with the ground, which is a source of new life. And since the masculine Adam, bear with me, is created from the feminine Adama, death could also be thought of as a kind of return to the womb. And the text presents this return as a release from the hard labor of life. Contrary to the construal of death as punishment, it is presented as a return to which we belong, a return to which we have always belonged, a kind of homecoming. Two very interesting things happen next. The first is this. Our only clue to the human response comes in the form of the Adam's next reported action. The Adam called his woman Chava because she was the mother of all living. In a group-oriented society where salvation comes from the continuation of life, generation after generation, there can be little doubt that the name Chava is an honorific title. The woman has acted as an agent of human growth and furtherance, moving herself and the man toward the sexual maturity that allows for procreation. If we understand verses 14 through 19 as punishment for disobedience, with the woman uniquely responsible for bringing death into the world, this immediately preceding action seems strange. But if we understand those verses as the two learning about the realities of adult life, with the woman uniquely responsible for bringing life into the world, then the naming of the woman seems altogether appropriate. So could this maybe be the narrator's assessment of the woman's role in the story? The second interesting thing is this. Yahweh Elohim made for them garments of skins and clothed them. The idea that the eating of the fruit somehow fractured or damaged the divine-human relationship, leaving it in need of repair, has enjoyed a long history in the Christian tradition. But this idea is not supported in the text. Eating the fruit is not said to damage or change the divine-human relationship in any way. We hear about the relationship between male and female, the relationship between the humans and the earth, and the relationship... We hear about the relationship between male and female and between the humans and the earth, but nothing is actually said about the relationship between the humans and Yahweh Elohim. Yahweh Elohim continues to act in response to the needs of the humans, first by explaining to them the consequences of living with the knowledge of Tov and Ra, this adult knowledge that they have acquired, and second, by making for them more adequate garments of skins and clothing them. Two acts of considerable tenderness, the Adam's naming of the woman Chava and Yahweh Elohim's clothing of the human couple, proceed immediately from verses 14 through 19 and challenge, I think, their traditional interpretation as a series of punishments. Again, the narration seems to emphasize the truth of the serpent's words by echoing them. And Yahweh Elohim said, "Behold," it's my favorite word in the Hebrew Bible. It comes up all the time. Anyway, sorry, I can't help myself. "Behold, the Adam has become like one of us, knowing Tov and Ra." The term "fall" in relation to the Eden narrative does not occur in the Hebrew Bible. Carol Myers writes that its widespread use is a good example of how an interpretive concept can become so familiar that no one notices that it doesn't belong to the story itself. Yahweh Elohim's response, "The Adam has become like one of us," does not suggest any notion of a descent. In obtaining the capacity for the knowledge of Tov and Ra, the humans have, according to Yahweh Elohim, risen to a godlike state. And here the text challenges another idea that has enjoyed a long history in the Christian tradition, that their creation in the Imago Dei, in the image of God, is what makes the humans somehow godlike and distinguishes them substantially from the other created beings. According to the text, it is their trespass of the divine prohibition and consequent self-awareness that makes the humans somehow godlike. It is what has long been understood as their sin that makes them like Elohim. Conclusions. The author wanted the serpent to be a land animal and not a divine being, so we made it a divine being. They wanted to associate the woman with wisdom and courage, so we made her a fool and a slave. They wanted to tell a story about human freedom and agency, so we made it a story about human bondage and depravity. They wanted us to accept the oppositional forces of life and the reality of death as natural and essential parts of Yahweh Elohim's creation, so we made them unnatural enemy invaders. And such delusions have perhaps kept us from making our peace with reality ever since. We might rightly ask Christian tradition, "What is this you have done?" This is not a historical narrative, but a myth, which is to say, a story which has never happened and which happens every day, a story we all experience. The world did not suddenly change and come under divine curse at a certain point in antiquity because the first humans sinned by eating a piece of fruit. You never know. It's possible. But what we do know is that our perception of the world changes as we move from childhood to adulthood. Struggle and suffering and death do not suddenly enter the world. We simply become aware of them. We are naked long before we know our nakedness. There is, in the Eden myth, no paradise lost, no original immortality, no fallen state, no corrupted nature, no estrangement from God, no need for divine atonement, and nothing to blame women and scapegoat serpents for. You can, of course, find those things elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible. I'm simply suggesting that you're not really going to find them here in this story. The many problems and illogical aspects of the sin and fall interpretation are widely recognized by biblical scholars. Not only is the traditional interpretation incompatible with the biblical text, it is ethically problematic, as evidenced by its fruit throughout historic Christianity and its influence on Western consciousness, with particular regard to its estimation of women and of human nature. Our tradition's use of this sacred story has caused and continues to cause considerable harm. Thus, Christian exegetes have not only an intellectual responsibility to reconsider the Eden myth, but also an ethical imperative. The Eden myth is a rich and powerful narrative, and the maturation paradigm offers one alternative interpretation of it, one which acknowledges the integrity of the text, incorporates all its symbols and synchronic themes, gives meaning to the elements that have none in the sin and fall interpretation, and which offers a far more favourable assessment of all its characters. The implications of such a reading for Christian theology are significant, I grant you, but it is my contention that the posts supporting the traditional interpretation are not the various tools of the exegete, but rather the sheer weight and volume of tradition. There exists a chasm between biblical scholarship and systematic theology. The tendency has been for the dominant line of interpretation to stamp out alternatives in its bid to gain council approval and become the official position. Certain readings and understandings have come to be accepted. Sorry about that. Come to be accepted not because they are the best or most helpful, but because of a whole range of often deeply troubling social, political, and cultural factors. Alternatives are lost and forgotten, only to be rediscovered and redeveloped again and again by subsequent generations. Christian theology has built its empire upon certain readings of certain texts that are not necessarily the best readings and certainly not the only readings of those texts. The ideas and interpretations of culture-bound individuals and communities harden over time into false certitudes, and we retain certain beliefs and practices without pausing to reevaluate their roots and their merit. The serpent, the woman, the forbidden fruit, and the Eden myth in general are good examples of this tendency. At present, biblical scholars continue to proffer new methods and readings, while Christian theologians continue to work within frameworks that do not necessarily allow for the insights unearthed within biblical scholarship, and neither bridges the divide to engage in the necessary dialogue between the disparate disciplines. Grips must be loosened. Cracks must be allowed to appear. That's how the light gets in. And I wrote that. I wrote this before I knew the Leonard Cohen song, because it just made sense. And then I read it to my friend, and she's like, "Oh, you've gone full Leonard Cohen at the end." I was like, "Damn it!" So there you have it.
Thank you.
I think.
Do we have any questions at all? Now, just we'll get the microphone, okay?
Elise. So, in the punishment bit, in my head, Yahweh is angry. Like, is that in the text? Is Yahweh angry that they've done that?
I don't really know how he feels.
So it's not explicit?
It's not explicit.
Okay.
It's a tricky section.
Yep.
It's a really tricky section. I feel like this maturation paradigm makes really good sense up to a certain point. And then that's the part of the story where I kind of get a bit like, it's some of that language, like, cursed is the ground because of you. Like, it's hard to kind of get away from some of that language. It does seem quite negative. But it's a really tricky section with the sin and fall paradigm as well. Like, to be honest, it's a really weird passage, and no one really knows what to make of a lot of it. At first, he's talking about the serpent, and then some kind of like hostility that's going to exist between serpents and women, it's very strange. The most convincing thing that I've read talks about how a lot of the imagery in that section, like, you know, you'll strike his heel, you'll grab his heel and he'll strike your head. Other way around. Okay, thanks, guys. A lot of parallels between that section and the Jacob and Esau story. They come out of the womb that way, and Jacob means he who grasps the heel. Anyway, so in the maturation paradigm, people will say that it just kind of seems to indicate difficulties in family life, like that there will be difficulties. But in terms of Yahweh being angry, you don't really get those kind of descriptions, though, in Hebrew narrative. It's all, you kind of have to read between the lines a bit. But I would tend to sort of agree with you. Like, I also read it as him being like a little bit like, this is a bad thing that has happened. Yeah. Yeah. If I could just say one thing, though, about that as well. I think that oftentimes the sin and fall interpretation gets a bit of a free pass because we've taken it for granted for so long. The truth is, like, the sin and fall paradigm doesn't do a better job with that, but we kind of are like, we accept it because it's always been the case. Now,
you referred to God as Yahweh Elohim, which are alternative names. I was wondering why you use two of, I think there's another name too in some other part of the Old Testament, but I'm just wondering why you use the double name.
I'm just following the text. That's what.
It does use the double name.
Yeah. All through the story, the whole Garden of Eden story, it's Yahweh Elohim. Except for when the serpent and the woman have their dialogue, they just say Elohim. So I don't know what that's about. Yeah, so I guess the redactors, or, you know, subsequent generations that kind of altered or developed the story or whatever, maybe they've added Yahweh in as like that kind of personal name to say it was, because this is a story that exists in, it's kind of like part of the cultural canon, like it's a story that's floating around, and the Hebrew authors have kind of taken it and adapted their own version for themselves and for their communities. So maybe they've like added the personal name in to say it was our God, you know. but yeah, I'm just following the text.
This is just an observation. It occurred to me this morning that in 50 years in the church, in a wide variety of Christian communities and traditions, I have never had taught to me anything that suggests that men and women have different degrees of sinfulness, and of a particular evil in women. I've heard many sermons talking about this teaching being taught elsewhere in churches, but I've never heard it myself. I don't know why. I mean, clearly you can see there are gender issues that we have within our Christian communities that still need to be worked through, but I have never had that teaching which is talked about taught to me, and I wonder if it's a little bit overblown. That's just my observation. Maybe I've had a particularly sheltered upbringing, but I wouldn't have thought so myself.
Yeah. I think what happens is we, you know, here in our time and place, we've kind of inherited these ideas that have been developed for hundreds of years. And we've inherited these kind of watered down, or, you know, they've filtered through to us. So we end up with kind of something that is a combination of the original idea and our cultural influences and whatever. But when we, like for me, like the experience for me, like going back and looking at the roots of these ideas, it's really horrifying. And it becomes concerning because what happens is we kind of retain these ideas and we don't really understand where they've come from or how we got there. And I think, it's not as bad now. Just most people don't think that, most church-going people don't believe that women are just inherently more sinful than men, and they don't believe that only men are created in the image of God and women aren't or whatever. But I think it's important to go back and address the root, because as long as that root idea is not addressed, I do think it filters in, maybe in more insidious ways.
Say
again.
Yeah, that may be the
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the explicit subjugation of women that kind of finds its basis in the New Testament household codes, those texts rely on the Garden of Eden story. Like the passages in Corinthians and in Timothy, you see a movement from woman being inferior because she was created second to woman being inferior because she sinned first and was responsible for sin. So those passages, because the New Testament, people might not be reading the Garden of Eden story and saying women are inferior explicitly, but they're certainly kind of doing that with the New Testament, and those New Testament texts rely on a certain reading of the Garden of Eden story.
Yeah, I can certainly accept that, but I think the full narrative has also stood up without examination, even without the gender aspect. Even if you say, "Oh, they both went over the tree and picked the fruit," the story doesn't sort of suggest that she picked it and then found him and said, "Here, eat this." It does say the man who was with him, who was with her, but again, that doesn't change any of the rest of what you were of what you're saying, but I think there are a variety of different interpretations that people work with in the modern age.
Just a side comment, the roots of Islam are the same, and the idea of women being the source of evil, very strong there. But anyway, my comment was, thank you, Nika, that really helped me and made a lot of sense. Interestingly, last week I read the story of the Garden of Eden at home, and I was thinking, what's this bit about the knowledge of good and evil? What's that really mean? And I was watching my little dog playing with a toy, a squeaky toy, and boy, was she being vicious. She thought it was a real animal and she was doing her darndest to kill it. And I thought, if that was a real animal, we'd be horrified at her behaviour. But because she's only a dog, we just laugh. And that sort of gave me a clue that the animals don't have that sense of what's right and wrong. They operate out of instincts. So I thought, well, maybe Adam and Eve originally were like the animals. They just behaved out of instinct. And God gave us this sense of what is right and wrong and gave us the free will. And that seems to be what differentiates humans from animals, that ability to make a decision about what we're going to do, how we're going to behave. So what you've been saying sort of helps me fit that in.
Sure.
Can I ask in response to that, the notion of God being the one that supplies us with this kind of wisdom, what is good and what is evil, how does that fit in, I'm wondering, with the fact that in the narrative, it's more a sense of this is what God has withheld from man, and it's that actually we are stealing, we are plucking at the fruit of wisdom from the tree, and this is, we're actually almost, you know, this acquisition of knowledge is coming from thievery almost.
The idea that that the knowledge of good and evil is some kind of wisdom that they acquire, that's been a really popular idea. But the Hebrew words are actually just good and bad, because when we hear the word evil, I think we start thinking about morality. The Hebrew words are just good and bad. And if we understand that, as I kind of was arguing, as having the experience of what is good and bad. So, you know, when you're, you know, if we sort of envision them as being like children in a childhood world that is just a really pleasant place, that is sort of taken care of by the parent figure. And then as they sort of go through a process of maturation, they sort of become aware of the bad parts of life. You know, because when you're young, you kind of live in a cultivated world and your parents sort of take care of you, and then you get older and you learn about, oh, death is a thing and pain is a thing and suffering is a thing. That is sort of the maturation paradigm brings that sort of perspective. Does that sort of answer your question? The idea that it's like wisdom and that, yeah, that God kind of has withheld it from them and they take it is massively problematic. It's like, well, why wouldn't God want them to know the difference between good and evil? And how can they make the decision to eat the fruit in the first place if they can't discern between anything? Yeah, I've always felt really... I was drawn to this story because the traditional interpretation has never sat well with me. I've always kind of just been uncomfortable with it. Like, it doesn't make sense.
Sorry, Nika, you talked about wanting to look at this story as a... So what are the implications then, an application for our lives? If this story is not about some cosmic sin ledger thing that, you know, humanity, now there's a big gap between us and God. The role of the atonement, or Jesus' death and the cross, and all of that obviously changes. So I'm interested in what's the implication for that. In 1 minute, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that. The truth is, atonement theology is really problematic for a lot of people anyway. Even with the sin and fall paradigm, a lot of people have a lot of problems with the idea that God tortures and, you know, it's that whole cosmic child abuse sort of scenario, and that God has to kill Jesus in order to satisfy himself. Like, it's... So, I mean, there are alternative ways of understanding what happens on the cross. Like, I know Mike O'Neill, our theology guy at Vos, he I can't remember the specifics, but I know that there's Christ the exemplar. He talks about there are the different... Because, you know, in the New Testament, there are several metaphors that are used of what happens on the cross. And it's a mystery. Like, we don't really know what happened on the cross. We just know that somehow God was reconciling creation to God's self. Somehow. and there are several metaphors that are used. And they are metaphors, because we don't know what was going on. But the one that I've always kind of resonated most with, and I have to apologize, I don't remember the specifics, but Christ the exemplar, like Christ comes and he's showing us what it is to be human and how to live as a human in harmony with God, with each other, with creation, that whole kind of thing. That's a whole other thing to be explored. It's a whole other and very valid, like, yeah, there are massive implications. But only because we've made such a big deal of this story. And I kind of feel like at the end of the day, for a story that is so confusing and strange to us, like it's so far removed, there are like so many word plays in the story that we can recognize, but we don't know what they mean. Like, for example, the serpent is a room, crafty or street smart or wise. And then when the humans eat the fruit, they realize that they are Erom, naked, and then the serpent becomes the most Arur, like cursed of all the creatures. Like, there's a lot going on that is just very strange to us and we don't understand. So my feeling is that for a story that is this ambiguous, it really shouldn't be like one of the foundational tenets of theology. You know, like we really should loosen our grip a little bit with this story and acknowledge that it's strange to us. But for sure, I definitely want to acknowledge that there are massive implications to be explored.